On 88.1 WIPR, I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Maryland Morning. This morning, a conversation about the reasons behind the racial divide in America. While some argue that the violence we experienced here in Baltimore last year was the result of black anger bubbling over after years of systemic and institutionalized racism, in a new book, a scholar of African American history argues that the chasm between whites and people of color has been animated throughout our history by white reaction and opposition to any and all progress towards equality made by minorities. Dr. Carol Anderson joins me to talk about her new book, White Rage: The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. Then a visit with our nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle, and Evan Lutz, a young entrepreneur who's connecting food surpluses with people who are hungry. Tom Pelton puts the environment in focus. Nathan Sterner has the local news. Maryland Morning starts right after these headlines.
I'm producer Kathleen Cahill. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, and 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Morning, everybody. Glad you're with us. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. When violence erupted in Baltimore after the funeral of Freddie Gray last year, one of the narratives that immediately emerged was that of an African-American community convulsed with anger about the long history of racial and economic inequality. In this perspective, that anger simply boiled over when it came to light that Freddie Gray's death resulted from injuries he sustained while in the custody of the Baltimore Police Department. Freddie Gray joined Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, Tamir Rice, and a host of other young black men whose deaths fit a pattern of misconduct on the part of law enforcement and neglect by white society of the problems that have long challenged communities of color. Black rage was the reason for the violence and a wake-up call in cities across the country to ameliorate long-standing problems. My next guest paints a more nuanced picture. Dr. Carol Anderson, who chairs the African American Studies Department at Emory University in Atlanta, argues that the racial divide in America has been animated throughout our history by white reaction and opposition to any and all progress towards equality made by people of color. Her book is called White Rage: The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. Carol Anderson joins me in the studio. It's great to meet you. Thanks for coming.
Oh, thank you so much for having me this morning.
I got to tell you, I loved this book. I thought it was a really compelling argument that you make. And tell me if I've summed up that argument somewhat correctly. This is not about denying that there is black rage, that there's black anger, but you say that basically we had the focus on the fire, not the kindling.
Yes, absolutely. And part of that really is because when you think about how the United States operates, we're so drawn to that spectacular that we miss all of the things that went into those flames. And when you think about policy, because that's where my focus is, policy automatically hits the snooze alarm, right? But policy is so essential for trying to figure out how, when we have these epic struggles for equality, epic struggles for democracy, how we end up in the same kind of refrain of dealing with disfranchisement, of dealing with systemic racism. How does this happen? And it's by going through and looking at the ways that policy and legal decisions have come down through the years, particularly in these key moments when African Americans have advanced and have gained some measure of their citizenship rights. That's what I look at through White Rage.
You talk sort of almost in a sort of a stepwise pattern that, mm-hmm. People of color earn the right to vote, slavery is outlawed, 40 acres and a mule, et cetera, and then the white reaction to that is to up the ante, and then the black folks come to counter that, and white folks up the ante again.
Yeah, and I want to be clear, too. What happens is that in these struggles, you also see white folks who want a strong, viable democracy. But you have a wing that is entrenched and embedded and that is absolutely playing to the worst side of America, playing to our worst selves. Mm-hmm. And they craft policy. So you think about it. You have a people who have been enslaved for 250 years, not paid, when they are freed, you have measures put in Congress that say, okay, 40 acres and a mule, coming out of the Freedmen's Bureau. 40 acres and a mule to provide economic substance, an economic basis for real freedom. And that is immediately wiped away by President Andrew Johnson. You wipe away economic freedom while you also see President Johnson pushing through to wipe away any kind of measure to think about votes or any kind of measure to think about citizenship. You have black people who are now freed and no longer property, but they don't have any citizenship rights. They are so vulnerable that, in fact, what you have then is the mass murder and the kind of reinscription of slavery happening right after the Civil War.
You make the point that at some point in the history of our country, the 50s, the 60s maybe, white authority transformed the definition of racism so that it came to mean only the Ku Klux Klan and the water hoses on the demonstrators. And you call it a cloud of racial innocence that covers many white people.
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
You'll hear things like, well, you know, I worked hard. All black people have to do is. And you fill in that blank. And what that does, it means that you don't have to then take into account all of those years where government policy has, in fact, supported the rise of whites, from FHA loans where blacks were absolutely excluded from for decades, which helped build the white middle class. It means you don't have to take into account all of the student loans and the money that went into public education to make sure that you had the kind of education that you needed in order to be competitive. So you get this kind of, well, you know, all black people have to do. So that allows what I call that kind of racial innocence, which then means that there is no structural inequality. There is no structural racism. Everything that we see is then just based on individual drive and individual initiative.
You mentioned President Andrew Johnson acting at the federal level, mm-hmm. but much of your book talks about how the southern states were in opposition to the federal government, to congressional action, mm-hmm. and so many times it took congressional action to intervene when southern states, going back to the Black Codes after Reconstruction, conceived by some of the South's most influential, you know, judges and politicians and planners. Is the South still a different universe from the rest of the country when it comes to not just sensitivity in matters of race, but in, you know, the systemic way people of color are treated?
I would say that the divide, it's more of form than substance. So what you see in the South is, for instance, think about the debates over the Confederate flag. Right. And so it's our heritage. And so you won't see that, for instance, in California.
Right.
Right. You won't see that in Michigan. You'll see other variations of it. I go back to the Lee Atwater quote as he's crafting the Southern strategy.
He's the campaign manager for George H.W. Bush.
Yes.
Worked with Reagan, too. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it's like, how do we bring in the formerly solid Democratic South into the Republican Party? As he says, we can't use the N-word anymore. We could say it in 1954. We can't say it in 1968. So we use other words, these euphemisms, forced busing, states' rights, cutting taxes, and all of those things, Atwater says, it means that subconsciously blacks get hurt worse than whites. And that's what you see happening in Pennsylvania. When Pennsylvania puts through a voter ID law, it's what we see happening in Ohio, when Ohio's putting through a voter ID law. Now,
This is also happening in Texas and North Carolina, but it's not limited to the South.
Exactly. And that's what I think is so important to understand. Part of the reason why the civil rights movement could be the civil rights movement is that initially its focus was on the South, which then allowed the North, the West, and the Midwest to go, ooh, you know, the South has never really been able to have it all together. And it provides a level of innocence where you don't have to look internally at yourself to see, what is my role in this? How complicit am I in this. So that's why I don't want to just say this is a Southern thing, although it is entrenched in the South.
Yeah. And Nixon, for example, seems to be the person credited with, you know, really developing this Southern strategy. Mm-hmm. Haldeman, his aide, you know, talked about how you can't say it overtly, but as you say, you've got to make the point. Mm-hmm. And of course, Nixon is, you know, running in the direct aftermath of the civil rights movement.
One of the ways that white rage works is to use these beautiful euphemisms that swaddle themselves in patriotic language, in language that you couldn't logically be against. Who could be against law and order? Who could be against the war on drugs? Who could be against stopping voter fraud and protecting the integrity of the ballot box? All of that sounds great, but when you pull back the layer, what you see is this teeming, seething racial hatred designed to, in fact, gut the advancement of African Americans and other minorities to their citizenship rights.
One of the arguments, for example, against Brown versus Board of Education was made on a constitutional basis. I mean, the argument against Brown was not made racially, it was made constitutionally.
Yes, you know, and so the argument was that this was states' rights, that the state had a right to, in fact, figure out what to do with its schools. I'm going to move from Brown to the Rodriguez decision and the Milliken decision. You know, Brown says that separate but equal is unconstitutional. It cannot be the law of the land, undermining, undercutting, overturning Plessy. The Rodriguez decision deals with equal funding for schools. The primary basis of public school funding are property taxes. And what we know is the role that public policy plays in determining the value of property. So where cities choose to put the landfill, where the cities choose to have zoning laws that allow certain types of businesses, but not other types of businesses.
It's all of a piece. Yeah.
It's all of a piece. That has so much to do with property values. In San Antonio, the Edgewood District, which was 96% Mexican American and Black, had the lowest property value in the city. They taxed themselves at the highest rate. They only generated $21 per student, taxing themselves at the highest rate. The white district, primarily white district, Alamo Heights, they taxed themselves at a very low rate and garnered 1,500% more in student funding per capita. The Supreme Court said, that is absolutely fine in 1973. So we're almost 20 years after Brown. We're still fighting for equal education. And the Supreme Court says there is no constitutional right to education.
They're all so interconnected, the interrelatedness of policy and specific ways of approaching how communities are living are all part of the systemic racism. All right, really interesting stuff. Dr. Carol Anderson is the chair of the Department of African American Studies at Emory University and the author of several books, the latest of which is called White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. Let's talk about the reaction to the civil rights movement. Between 1970 and 1978, you report that African Americans enrolled in college, the number doubled. Yeah. College degrees were up to 6%, up from 4% just a few years earlier. But by the 1980s, there's 15,000 fewer African Americans enrolled in college, even though more of them were graduating from high school. Yes. So what's that all about?
That is about the policies that particularly President Ronald Reagan put in place. Nixon started it with the appointments that he made to the U.S. Supreme Court, where you begin to see the kind of whittling away. When we get to Reagan, you see one of the first things that they did was to rework the student financial aid packages. Remember, you have a deep level of poverty and inequality coming out of the Black community. You had, what was it, about five times as many African-American students who were going to college. Their families made $12,000 or less a year. But there were robust student loan and student grant programs available prior to that. With the onset of Reagan, they tweaked the student financial aid packages so that the needier you were, the harder it was to access the funds. That makes no sense.
And what was the premise of that argument?
The premise of that argument was that we need to go more towards loans, that education was not something that the federal government really should be investing in, and we needed to treat this as a privilege, not a right, and that we're in hard economic times, and so that loans made more sense. So again, the language has beautiful rhetoric.
But then you make the point that what happens in the 80s and the 90s is that we've had four decades of what you call stall and delay, stall and deny,
yes,
in terms of access to higher education. And we've got millions of citizens who lack an education, and this makes the country uncompetitive.
Although the target is African-American advancement, what it does is it so undermines the strength and the viability of American democracy, of the nation itself. So when you have a nation that systematically refuses to educate millions of its citizens, and you could almost pull that off when you had a large manufacturing sector. But as the nation and the global economy moves toward a knowledge-based economy, what you really need is brain power. And when you systematically have policy after policy after policy that says, no, only a certain number will be educated, then you're setting that nation up to fail. That is where we are.
You're right that in 2004, there was not one African-American awarded a PhD in astronomy.
Yes.
There were 2,100 PhDs awarded in the sciences overall, and none to African Americans. And this, you know, leads to just lack of competition. So when people talk about India and Japan and, you know, China.
In the late 1950s, the battle over Brown is hot and heavy in the South. Then we have Sputnik in 1957. The Soviets launched this satellite. There is fear quaking through the American national security sphere and in the American public, because it means that the Soviets now have the ability to actually send nuclear weapons across the ocean and hit the United States. In the middle of this national security crisis, the legislators who are leading the fight in Congress for the National Defense Education Act, which is going to pour hundreds of millions of dollars into public schools to create these scientists and engineers, they insist upon, and the federal government agrees, that schools that defy Brown will not be denied access to hundreds of millions of dollars. And so here you have these universities that are creating scientists and engineers, but not as many as could be, because we have, as a nation, have said it's okay to deny access to American citizens to an education.
There was one place you listed, and it's escaping me where it was, that actually closed its schools for like 6 years or something rather than comply with Brown.
Absolutely.
So the adamancy of the opposition to this was... Crazy.
Prince Edward County in Virginia closed its schools for 5 years. And you begin to think about what that means for a child's education. That from, say, the time you're in the fifth grade, you're 10 years old, to the time when you're supposed to be a sophomore in high school, that you don't have a school. Think about all of the knowledge and all of the skills you have not had access to. And they did this. There were 2,700 black children that they shut out of those schools. Meanwhile, they provided state funding and county funding to ensure that white children could go to Prince Edward Academy, an all-white private school. And so this is why when you look in the South, you'll see a lot of white private academies whose start date is in the late 1950s, because this was the response to Brown.
Dr. Carol Anderson, she's on the faculty and the head of the African American Studies Department at Emory University. Her book is called White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Marilyn Morning. Closing schools, deliberately not educating millions of people, is one of these examples of, you know, deliberate creation of a crisis that,
yes,
could have been avoided.
Yes.
One of the other ones you talk about is the drug problem, having to do with American foreign policy in the Reagan administration.
In Nicaragua, Anastasia Somoza is overthrown. He is a right-wing dictator. He's overthrown by a combination of Marxists, the Sandinistas, and middle-of-the-road Nicaraguans who are just absolutely disgusted with Somoza. What the Reagan administration sees, however, is a communist takeover and authorizes a right-wing group of guerrillas to overthrow the Sandinista government. How are they going to finance it? Because the U.S. is just coming out of Vietnam. What the Reagan administration and the Contras come up with is to, in fact, use the cocaine trafficking and the proceeds, the profits from those drugs to, in fact, buy weapons to help train the Contras. They flood the United States with cocaine. And this is facilitated by the National Security Council, particularly Oliver North, and the CIA. When drugs hit so hard, that's when Reagan then comes out with a really strong war on drugs message that criminalizes the use of drugs and makes the distinction between cocaine and crack.
And the sentences and convictions of largely African Americans,
yes,
for crack greatly outweigh those of white people doing powder cocaine.
And added to that is the disparity and the discrepancy in the way that the policing worked, so that the police would focus in on the black community.
Murakawa, you quote her, she says, the U.S. didn't face a crime problem that was racialized. It faced a race problem that was criminalized.
Absolutely.
And of course, many people, Michelle Alexander and Brian Stevenson and other people have written about this. And that, the incarceration rates lead to, that bleeds into all sorts of stuff, including voting.
Oh, big time.
And you write a lot about voting and efforts to suppress votes. Do you think that efforts to make it harder for people to vote, again, premised on the assumption that there is voter fraud, or at least the possibility of voter fraud, is that a reaction to Obama? But you also make the point that it's not just a reaction to Obama, the fact that he's an African-American president, but that there is a long legacy of stuff that preceded that.
Yeah, there's a long legacy of voter curtailment, voter suppression, disfranchisement that goes back at least to Reconstruction and then really rears its head in full during the rise of Jim Crow. Because of a combination of terrorism and the poll tax, where you had to pay to be able to vote, you had in the 1942 election, 3% of the voting population actually cast a vote in the 1942 midterm election in the poll tax states. 3%. So there is a long history, and that is part of what led to the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Immediately, you saw Richard Nixon going after, and John Mitchell, his attorney general, going after the Voting Rights Act in 1970. So just 5 years after this law is in place. And the Voting Rights Act has been vulnerable ever since.
Of course, it had to be renewed periodically.
Yes.
And Congress renewed it pretty regularly.
Yeah.
But until the Supreme Court stepped in and gutted part of Section 4 related to Section 5,
mm-hmm.
Having to do with what's required to show when you vote, and having to do with the assumption that there's no longer a problem in particular jurisdictions.
Right. And using really faulty logic in that, so John Roberts basically was calling the Voting Rights Act archaic, that it wasn't meeting the modern needs of, the current times, except it was. You had bail in and bail out provisions so that you could bail out if you had stopped discriminating against your citizens in terms of their right to vote.
The Justice Department had to make that determination.
Yes. So the municipalities or the states would have to provide the documentation that they weren't trying to rig the system. They weren't trying to disfranchise. So think about this. So all you have to do in order to get bailed out is to stop discriminating. You just have to stop breaking the law. And yet we have the Supreme Court saying, well, that's not fair. This is that weird kind of Kafka moment where we get to. And so you see the moment that the Shelby County v. Holder decision came through, that the Supreme Court put down to gut parts of the Voting Rights Act, you saw these states just pounce immediately with these voter suppression laws. So one of the laws that I talk about there is the SB 14 out of Texas. Here you have Attorney General Greg Abbott talking about rampant voter fraud, and he can only point to two cases out of 10 million votes. Two cases. But what is also documenting is that you have about 600,000 minorities and poor people who cannot gain access to the required government-issued photo ID.
Yeah, because what's required to get those IDs is often really difficult. Birth certificates and, you know, you make points like when people, multiple families, which is a common practice in the Hispanic community, particularly multiple folks and generations of families live in the same house.
Yes.
But there's only one utility bill and it gets sent to one person. So
correct.
That person's name's on the utility bill. If you live there, you can't bring that utility bill and say, see, this is my address.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. What's the solution to this?
I think the solution, and I think we're on to it, I really do, is that we're paying attention. We're asking the next question when we hear this, you know, wonderful rhetoric about protecting the integrity of the ballot box, where we're talking about cutting taxes. We're saying, whose taxes and who gets hurt and why? What's really behind this? It's that we stand up and we fight. It's that we register to vote regardless of the strictures that are put up. We find a way to get to that ballot box, because the way that we begin to change this policy is that we begin to demand a better, more humane, and more democratic nation.
Brookings Institution in 2013, right after the 2012 election, a scholar named William Fry reported that for the first time, turnout in the black community was higher than the white community. So
yes.
Maybe this trend is starting to change. And of course, obviously, the current political landscape, you've got Lindsey Graham saying there just aren't enough angry white guys anymore. We've got to reach out to other people.
We'll
see how the standard bearer does with that for the Republican Party.
Yeah.
Well, Carol Anderson, this has been a pleasure talking to you. This is a terrific read, and I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Carol Anderson, the book is called White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. It's published by Bloomsbury. We've got a link to more information on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall on 88.1 WIPR. You're listening to Maryland Morning. We are grateful for that. Lots more coming up. Stay with us.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. It's time now for our monthly feature called Smart Nutrition. As always, I'm joined by our nutrition diva, Monica Reinagel. She's a licensed nutritionist who blogs at Nutrition Over Easy and whose weekly podcasts appear on quickanddirtytips.com. We're also joined by Evan Lutz, the co-founder of Hungry Harvest, an organization which seeks to solve two problems. Number one, cutting down on the enormous amounts of food that gets wasted every year, and reducing hunger among people who are confronting food insecurity. Evan Lutz is a 2014 graduate of the University of Maryland, and earlier this year, he pitched the idea for Hungry Harvest on ABC Television's Shark Tank and came away with $100,000 from an investor to support his Baltimore-based company. Monica, always good to see you. And Evan, it's terrific to meet you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me in this studio. I really appreciate it.
Sure. So, Monica, this problem of food waste is huge. There are some estimates that say about 40% of the food that we produce in the United States ends up in a landfill.
Isn't that shocking and unfortunate? Because, as you mentioned, we still have a lot of people in this country who don't have enough to eat. So it's troubling on that level. But there are also environmental consequences. You know, it's not just composting in the landfill. It's actually creating an enormous amount of greenhouse gases. And that's something else that we're really worried about. So reducing the amount of food that ends up in the landfill is a high priority, I think, for all of us, certainly for me. And so I've talk a little bit about how we can address this at the household level, you know, some techniques that we can use just so that we're not throwing away so much food at home.
And composting is certainly one of them, use it in your garden.
Right? Yes, because then at least those nutrients are going back into the soil. And a lot of it at the household level comes down to sort of inventory management. It's keeping track of what's in the refrigerator, especially the fresh perishable stuff, whether it's vegetables that you bought or leftovers that you brought home from a restaurant, and having a plan to use them before they go bad instead of just letting them sit in there until they catch your attention because of the strange odor that's emanating.
For example, it's better to shop more frequently, buy smaller amounts of stuff a few times a week rather than try to buy food for the whole week. Would you say that's a good idea?
For some people, that's a good option. For others, if they don't have that option, I think it's also just a matter of being strategic about what you've got and using it up before it goes bad and having a plan. So that can help a little bit. But I think the scale of the problem is much larger. There's so much food that gets wasted on the industrial level, at the retail level, where retailers have more fresh food than they can use for various reasons, and it turns out to be cheaper to throw it away than to store it or to transport it to get it to the person that could use it. And that's why I was so thrilled to find out about Hungry Harvest and Evan's project here.
So, Evan, this is where you step in. You find these people who are throwing this food away, and you get it. And then you, by various ways, get it to other people. So first of all, who are you getting the food from?
Sure. So we work with local farms, wholesalers, and packing houses. And everything we source is pre-retail. There's 6 billion pounds of produce that gets thrown away in the United States every single year. And that's enough to fill up 4 NFL-sized stadiums, right? And half of that food, so 3 billion pounds of produce, gets wasted before it ever touches a retail store. In the warehouse, in the farms, in the packing houses, where it gets sorted out, left on the farm because it's ugly or doesn't look right. And that's not acceptable to me.
So you're making this food available that people can purchase. People subscribe to a service, and then you send them food like on a biweekly or a monthly basis. Tell me how that works.
Exactly. So people can sign up on our website, and they get a box of produce that's delicious, that's fresh, that's nutritious, that would otherwise be wasted because it's simply ugly, right? We have carrots that have 2 legs, or apples that are too small, or eggplants that have funny noses. None of it's bad or rotten or mealy. It just looks a little bit different, right? And so you get it to your door, and once a week or biweekly, and then for every box we deliver to a customer, we also donate a healthy meal to someone in need.
All right. So there are homeless shelters and places that are distributing food to people who need it and can't afford it. And you're subsidizing that by having people pay a retail price, essentially, for these slightly damaged goods, right? But you call it recovered produce, for example. So recovered from what?
Right. So recovered from going into the landfill, where Monica talked about the harmful greenhouse gases that produces. And if food waste was a country, it would be the 3rd largest producer of greenhouse gases behind the United States and China. That's the scale of the problem that we're talking about. And it's just not acceptable to me when we've got hundreds of thousands, millions of people that are hungry in this country, can't afford or can't have access to healthy food, that we're wasting all this perfectly edible, delicious, nutritious food.
Yeah. And Monica, the look of it is really important. I remember 10 years ago, so I was talking to John Shields, who runs Gertrude's restaurant at the BMA, and this is right at the very beginning of the farm-to-table movement, and he was talking about one of the barriers being that, for example, if he's going to serve roasted red potatoes, the potatoes all had to look uniform, which is why he was buying them from these wholesalers who, you know, weeded out the ones that didn't look uniform. And because consumers who were paying, you know, $20, $30, $40 an entree expected the food to look like a commercial. People need to just get over it. Huh?
Well, I have to say, when I learned about Hungry Harvest, I signed right up because I was excited about the model for reducing food waste. And I've gotten a couple of boxes of produce now. And I have to say, I have yet to see an ugly fruit or vegetable in my box. I mean, maybe they're not exactly the same size as you might be accustomed to seeing in the grocery store, but this is beautiful, fresh produce. I've been really impressed. And you mentioned, you know, that we're buying it at retail. I would have to say we're buying it significantly below retail. The value of what they're able to deliver to us for a very low cost is very impressive. So I have to say, I don't find this stuff ugly in the least, or even odd looking. It's been fantastic.
Monica Reinagle is the nutrition diva. Evan Lutz is the co-founder of Hungry Harvest on 88.1. It's our Smart Nutrition segment here on Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. So Evan, right now in the middle of the summer, obviously you can source this food locally. What happens in the winter when local farms aren't growing anything?
Sure. We take a higher priority over making sure food does not go to waste rather than it being exclusively local. Obviously, we'd love to work with local farms and wholesalers year-round, right? But there's food waste that's happening everywhere. And so we work with a lot of farms in Georgia and South Carolina and Florida and California during the non-growing season where they have stuff that's, you know, would go to waste because of its odd size or shape, which just isn't acceptable to us.
Is it kind of like a CSA? In other words, you choose what people are going to get.
It's not like a CSA because you don't get chard and kale and beets every week. We give you a really, really good variety that are changing on a weekly basis, and you can actually include things that you don't like. You can put that on your profile, and we'll make sure you never get that to your house. We'll supplement it with something else.
Uh-huh. And how about, is it organic?
We do have organic options as well, but organic farms are really good about not having a lot of surplus and waste. So that's a really good thing that they've cut down on a lot of the excess that they would normally produce.
So they're a little bit better at it, perhaps, than some of the bigger commercial farms, certainly.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Because, I mean, a lot of this food, as you say, just ends up in the field. I mean, never even gets picked.
Exactly. And I think the statistic is 7% of everything grown at a farm is actually left there right on the farm.
Yeah. Now, I know, Monica, Giant Foods, Whole Foods, they each have programs in which they're giving their surplus meats and stuff like that to and other foods to shelters and stuff. I know that Whole Foods gives it to the St. Francis Center and Reservoir Hill. Giant had a program that started with 4 stores. Now it's up to 52 where they're taking frozen meat that they can't sell. It's past the due date, but it's not bad, and it's not bad for you either, right?
Yeah, I think this food recovery movement is something that's gaining a lot of traction as people have become more aware of the problem, and there are a lot of people looking for creative ways to solve it. There's some on-campus groups that are doing a lot of work with on-campus food service and trying to just route that food to, kitchens or food banks. And, you know, it's very exciting to see the programs that get this into the food banks because food banks tend not to have a lot of fresh food.
Right.
It's mostly canned and shelf-stable.
Yeah. So this is a thing. This is happening. Well, I'm delighted. Delightful to meet you, Evan, and I think this is a really interesting idea, and I really appreciate both of you guys coming in.
Thank you so much.
Monica Reinagle is our nutrition diva and my co-conspirator every month for our Smart Nutrition segments here on Maryland Morning. Monica blogs at Nutrition Over Easy, and she does a weekly podcast on quickanddirtytips.com. Evan Lutz is the co-founder of Hungry Harvest. To learn more about Hungry Harvest, come to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. That'll do it for us today. We'll be back at you on Friday morning. Until then, for Nathan Sterner and the entire Maryland Morning team, thanks for listening. Have a great day.